Good morning, and thank you all for being here today. Today we'll be taking a look at a koan, case number 55 in the Hekigan Roku. The case reads, one day, Dao Wu, accompanied by his disciple, Qian Yan, went to pay his condolences at the house of a man who had just died. Qian Yan, tapping the coffin, said, alive or dead? Wu said, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Yan said, why won't you say? Wu said, I won't say. On their way home, Yan said, teacher, if you don't tell me, I will hit you. Wu said, you may hit me if you like, but I won't say. Qian Yan struck Dao Wu. Later, Dao Wu passed away. Qian Yan went to Shi Shuang and brought up the foregoing story. Shi Shuang said, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Upon these words, Qian Yan had a realization. One day, Qian Yan, carrying a hoe, went to the lecture hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east, as if he were searching for something. Shi Shuang said, what are you doing? Qian Yan said, I am looking for the relics of our late master. Shi Shuang said, vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master do you seek? Shui Do comments, alas, alas. Qian Yan said, it is a way of acquiring strength. Fu of Tai Yan said, the late master's relics are still present. Both the masters in this case appear in the ancestral line that we chant at every Taisho and chanting service. Dao Wu, whose Japanese name is Dogo, lived from 1768 to 835 in the Common Era. Shi Shuang, Japanese name Sekiso, his Dharma successor, lived from 807 to 889. As I'm sure most people here are aware, Candy, my wife, died a couple of weeks ago of pneumonia after suffering with multiple sclerosis for nearly 30 years. As I sat with her during her last hours, I naturally thought a lot about death. It would be pretty hard not to. I've been thinking a lot about death since then and how to deal with it. Not just Candy's death or mine, but death itself. This is one of the few koans that addresses the matter directly. One day, Dao Wu, accompanied by his disciple, Qian Yan, went to pay his condolences at the house of a man who had just died. Qian Yan, tapping the coffin, said, alive or dead? We are all going to die sometime. Some of us will die years from now, but we don't know how many. Others may die tomorrow or 1 minute from now. We really don't know. But most of us, I suspect, are to some extent in denial about death. Yes, we know it will happen, but not now, and not in the foreseeable future. I wonder if it is even possible to really visualize or imagine our own death. Dying, yes. We can come up with all sorts of scenarios about time, place, season, situation, and manner of dying. But death itself, that is another matter. It is death that is unimaginable. Alive or dead? That's the sort of question that might come up in Chosun. Say, teacher, are you alive or dead? Test the teacher. How will he or she respond? But Qian Yin is not playing games here. He is desperate. He knows perfectly well that the guy in the box is dead, and he doesn't like it. He asks, alive or dead? Maybe in the hope that Dao Wu will give him some words of comfort, something about the unborn, undying self-nature, or some such nonsense. I remember the first dead person I ever saw. I was around 7 or 8 years old, and my grandfather was laid out in the casket at the funeral home. We all paraded past him. My stepfather was right behind me, and he murmured in my ear, "It's just like he's sleeping." Well, even at that age, I knew better. Alive was standing up, talking, walking, eating. Dead was lying still and silent in the coffin. I found it all very mysterious and a bit frightening, but only in an abstract sort of way. But I was old enough to know that after that viewing, I would never see my grandfather again. Qian Yin asks, alive or dead? Dao Wu says, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Now, what is that answer about? Is Dao Wu refusing to answer the question, abandoning his disciple? Sorry, kid, you're going to have to figure that one out yourself. Is he dodging the question? Well, let's see. If I say alive, I'm ignoring this dead guy in front of me. If I say dead, what does that say about my understanding of the living truth? That all things, the sun, the moon, the great wide earth, are myself, including this corpse. Boy, I sure don't want to get caught up in dichotomy here. I think I'll just not say. If you conceive of Dao Wu's intent and understanding in this way, then you have missed it. Qian Yin asks again, why won't you say? And Dao Wu says, I won't say. What is this, I won't say? Zen masters are not in the habit of answering questions. It is the way of the master not to answer the question, but to answer the student. A master, whether teacher or not, answers the situation in the here and now. Thomas Merton, commenting on his vow of obedience that he took upon becoming a Trappist monk, said that it is about obedience to the situation, to see clearly what is, and to respond appropriately in the moment. How do we do that? How does any of us answer our situation in this moment? By being exactly who we are in the moment and nothing else. Don't try to escape. Don't seek something else. Dao Wu answers the student, "I won't say." This is Dao Wu at that moment. Now perhaps Dao Wu might have answered, as Bodhidharma answered the Chinese emperor, "I don't know." But that makes it too easy on Qian Yin. "I don't know" is almost an escape hatch into some astral plane of not knowing. No, Dao Wu will not allow the student to avoid facing the question, alive or dead. Thus he says, "I won't say." Well, at this point, Qian Yin can't handle it. So he threatens the teacher. "Teacher, if you don't tell me, I will hit you." But Dao Wu sticks to his position. "You may hit me if you like, but I won't say." So Qian Yin winds up and pops him a good one. In the commentaries, it is noted that Qian Yin has to get out of town. Striking a Zen teacher is a major felony. It would not be safe for him to return to the monastery. But sometime later, after Dao Wu's death, Qian Yin confesses the matter to Shi Shuang, Dao Wu's successor, and asks him the same question. And he gets the same answer. "I won't say alive, and I won't say dead." But this time, Qian Yin has a deep insight. Sometime later, we are told. But how long? We don't know. We can linger with a question or a koan for years, maybe decades. And then one day, for no discernible reason, pow, we get it. I don't think one can explain these things except by some glib reference to karma, but that's okay. It just happens. "I won't say alive, and I won't say dead. I won't say." There is a tendency to look at death and a dead person in a dismissive kind of way, as if they have really gone off somewhere. "Oh, well, he or she will live on in loving memory." What a thing to say. Suppose I didn't happen to like the deceased. Will he or she live on in my resentful memory or my angry memory or my hateful memory? What am I doing to that person? What if I forget all about them? Did I just kill them? Candy lives on in a very real sense, but neither my memory nor my attitude has anything to do with it. In a previous teisho on case number 2 in the Wu Men Guan by Zhang's Fox, I presented an argument based on the dialectic of Nagarjuna to the effect that we, each one of us, is the effect of the myriad causes, that is, of the universe. And further, that we, each one of us, is the cause of the myriad effects, that is, of the universe. Each one of us is the universe, here and now. There can be no separation of anything, not in time, not in space. Candy is cause and effect. She is all causes and all effects. Where can life and death come into it? Distinctions between life and death are important only to the extent that we limit ourselves and others to a certain set of arbitrarily chosen sensory impressions and ideas. I take in certain sensory impressions, put some of them together, and call this a lectern. And in so doing, I limit it. I exclude everything else. The more we can let go of these limitations and exclusions that we use to define ourselves and others, the more free we are. To say alive or to say dead is to abandon this truth. It is to limit ourselves by imposing conditions upon our true nature, which has no condition and no limits. If I snuff out a burning candle, have I killed something? That bright dancing flame has become a dark and smoking wick. Did something die? Only if I cling to one and reject the other. The flame is whole and complete, containing all past and future. The wick is whole and complete, containing all past and future. But like most of us do with those we love and are attached to, I limited candy to a certain sense of sensory impressions, thoughts, and so forth that I assembled into candy. In her dying, candy has forced me to make a choice. I can continue to mourn the loss of that set of impressions and thoughts, or I can set her free from those limitations that I imposed upon her. I have chosen to set her free as best I can. This is not to deny the fact of the woman I loved for so many years. But to cling to that particular psychophysical phenomenon as the only or even the most important part of candy would not be doing her or me any favors. And I cannot truly set her free unless I simultaneously set myself and all beings free. Therefore, I must say of candy, I won't say alive, and I won't say dead. Daou's answer is not an abandonment of his student, nor is it a clever avoidance of the question. It is the only possible answer he can give. To do otherwise would be a betrayal of his own practice and realization. But be careful. This is not a rationalization to abandon compassion, empathy, or love. It is not a way into some state of complacency where we no longer care about others. Over her last years, I often chafed at the fact that Candy never wanted to talk about death or dying. I thought that we should discuss it like real Buddhists, but all she wanted to do was to live her life day to day. And she was right. In her last years, her practice became increasingly compassion, gratitude, and a great generosity of spirit. I saw Candy at the nursing home as usual on the evening of Wednesday, February 21st. She was about as alert as she had been over the last couple of months, but she had become very, very weak. I read to her a while, fed her supper, and read to her some more. At 6 o'clock, I took her back to her room, brushed her teeth as usual, told her I loved her, and she said the same to me. We said goodbye, and I left. The next morning, about 6:30, I got a phone call. Candy's mom had gone into her room and found her in a kind of fetal position, struggling for breath and unconscious. The aides had been in the room not long before And at that time, she had been awake and alert. So something had come on very suddenly and severely. At first, the nurses thought it might be a heart attack or a pulmonary embolism. But after a while, it became evident that it was another pneumonia. She had had more such episodes than I can count, and had pulled through them against all odds and predictions. But those other times, although she was lethargic and often disoriented, she was always awake to some degree. Not this time. During that day, she may have recognized me or her mom, but she was unable to speak. And as time wore on, she went deeper and deeper into a coma. From the time she entered the nursing home, she insisted that there be standing orders for comfort care only if such a situation arose. So, no heroic measures were taken. She was given enough morphine to ease her breathing as much as possible, and medication to try to keep the fever down. But that was all. All through the next 2 days, she continued. Sometimes she seemed fairly relaxed. At others, she was struggling for breath, the congestion rattling loudly in her throat. Saturday morning, her temperature went up again, and her breathing began to get more irregular and shallow. About 8 o'clock, after a few more half-hearted attempts to continue, she gave it up. She was 3 weeks short of her 60th birthday. During the long vigils of the night, as she lay there, breathing in that gurgling rattle, I was assailed by doubts. Did I do the right thing? Should I have sent her to the hospital to be intubated and hooked up to a respirator, punctured for IV fluids, a nasogastric tube inserted, a cardiac monitor and defibrillator attached? Was it too late to do that, to drag her back into the semblance of life that she had had? At the same time, I knew that every time the subject came up of various methods of resuscitation, she was adamant. No, no, no. But did I do the right thing? I don't know. A couple of years ago, I spoke at some length about the death of my mother. I went on about how by simply letting things be, not wanting things to be different, one might be able to achieve a feeling of freedom and spaciousness, even in the face of death. Well, with all the wisdom of hindsight, I think that I made it sound way too easy. I tried that with Candy. I tried to let it all be, to practice into the sorrow and the doubt and the knot in the pit of my stomach. It didn't work. I knew in some sense that she was dying in her own way at her own time, and I didn't want her to live longer in the condition she had been in for the last 2 or 3 years. The fact is, I don't really know what I wanted, if anything. I suspect that that particular practice didn't work because I didn't really want it to work. Candy was in no position to change her condition or what was happening. Why should I want to for myself? Dying is not easy. It's very hard. Being with someone who is dying, especially one whom you love dearly, is not easy. That is very hard. I don't know that it is supposed to be easy. My wife was dying, and I felt awful. That's the truth. One day, Chen Yin, carrying a hoe, went to the lecture hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east as if he were searching for something. Shi Shuang said, "What are you doing?" Chan Yen said, "I am looking for the relics of our late master." Looking for the relics of the master. Let me explain a bit about relics. In certain Buddhist traditions, especially in Southeast Asia and Tibet, it is said that when the body of a holy person is cremated, there are left in the ashes small bits of what I suppose are indestructible stuff that are signs of the spiritual power of that person. These are objects of great veneration. A few years ago, a traveling display of relics of some of the great masters was housed for a couple of days here at the Zen Center. It was part of a fundraising effort for the Maitreya Project, a planned 500-foot-tall Maitreya figure to be erected in India. It was an impressive affair. We had set up all sorts of little altars with candles and incense, and every Buddha figure we could find in the building. A great many reliquaries were housed in a glass display case where you could look in and see little white pebbly-looking things. Each reliquary had a card identifying whose relics they were. They included many of the masters whose names we are familiar with, as well as some ancient Tibetan lamas whom I didn't know. There was, of course, a very elaborate one containing relics of Shakyamuni Buddha, and even one containing relics of Kashyapa Buddha, the non-historical Buddha of a previous Kalpa. I'm not sure how they got those. But what was really remarkable was the hundreds of people who came. There were many elderly folks from the various ethnic Buddhist communities in and around Denver, and they circumambulated the display, hands in gassho, bowing reverently to each set of these relics. It was really wonderful. And then, of course, there were all the hippies, teeny boppers, and the mildly curious. While relics don't play a big part in Zen Buddhism, this is in no way to disparage the veneration of relics, especially if they are helpful in focusing the mind on the teachings of the Buddha or the masters. And sometimes they just help. Right now I'm wearing the watch that Candy wore in her last years. It's much nicer than my old one. I find myself reluctant to stop wearing the wedding band. I suppose I still have some letting go to do. But the problem with the notion of relics is that it is limiting. The notion that the spirituality of the Buddha is contained in little pieces of stuff in a glass container is not consistent with the teachings of the Buddha, who said, "If one tries to see me through form and color, he is going the wrong way. He cannot see the Tathagata." He also said, "If you practice my Dharma, you have seen me, even if you are far from me." So Chen Yin's statement has some basis in tradition. But nosing around a lecture hall looking for relics is nothing short of ludicrous. I suspect that Chen Yin is pulling Shi Xuan's leg a bit here. Shi Xuan said, "Vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master do you seek?" And at this point, Shui Do, the compiler of the Hekigan Roku, comments, "Alas, alas." It's a little hard to tell here, but I suspect that both Shui Shuang and Shui Do are laughing. Vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the skies. Yes, The relics of the late master are indeed the dust bunnies under the altar, the grit on the windowsill. But the relics of our late masters, our late loved ones, wives, parents, sons, daughters, teachers, are also the cup on the table, the rain, the wind, the screeching of tires, the song of birds, the laughter of children. Why in the world would you need to look for them? Chan Yin said, it is a way of acquiring strength. A way of acquiring strength. It is practice. It is the practice of mindfulness that leads beyond mindfulness, the awareness that leads beyond awareness. It is in practice that we eventually learn to see all in all. And then Fu of Taiyin, another master, commenting on this whole thing, wraps it up saying, the late master's relics are still present. Of course they are. How could they not be? Relics are all around us. We don't need to look for them. But we do need to practice constantly and hard in order to see them. So here I am, rambling on, doing what Master Dao Wu had the good sense not to. It's all very well to say such things, but Candy's ashes are now on my altar at home. If you tap the container and ask me, is Candy alive or dead, how do I respond? A monk asked Feng Shui, both speech and silence transgress. How can we be free and non-transgressing? Feng Shui recited a poem. A non-Buddhist once asked the world honored one, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for no words. The world honored one sat still. Alive or dead? You know, in the afternoon, I find myself looking at my watch to see if it's time to go see Candy, and I have to check myself. At some point, I will take her ashes into the mountains and scatter them. Exactly where will remain between me and Candy. And yes, I miss her. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.